came in 3 months ago. I just met her. She's all over the place. And I would like to ask Margot to open us up with the Serenity Prayer in Dutch. Kan je dat doen?
Oh, ja, ik pak hem even. Hang on.
Ja, moet ze hem weer gaan pakken en voorlezen.
Ja, dat is een halve minuut. Halve minuut.
Yeah. I asked for the Serenity Prayer. I'm like, are you for real? You have to go get it. Yeah, I'm going to go to get it.
She's new. She's new.
Funny. Yes.
I know it better in English for some reason. It's more appealing. Here we go in Dutch, guys. God geeft mij de gemoedsrust om te aanvaarden wat ik niet kan veranderen. Moed om te veranderen wat ik kan veranderen. En wijsheid om tussen deze twee het onderscheid te maken.
Dankjewel, Margo.
Alsjeblieft. Thank you. You're welcome.
And Mary Pearl, I'm going to turn it over to you. If you guys are looking for the traditions, they are posted on MSB recording already. As Mary Pearl has written them. Right, Billy? Right. I'm going to assume that that's right. Go ahead, Mary Pearl.
Okay, thank you, Yvonne. Thank you very much. Just remember, I am not conference approved. These traditions, as I have written them, are not conference approved. These are experienced. Approved by a bunch of us that for a year we tried doing this and we had a meeting on traditions and it improved our relationship. And so I have seen many people over the country who have used these and have written me and told me they are successful. So I'd like to share my experience, strength, and hope with you about how to work the traditions in your relationships. And we stopped last week on 6, so we're going to start with 7. Isn't funny, they're all numbered. That's so that we don't get lost, you know. Okay, 7. Each partner ought to strive to be fully self-supporting spiritually, emotionally, and physically. When I was helping others, I let my personal needs go. You know, I was always living through someone else. That this is where I take my life and its care back into my own hands and I become responsible for me. You know, I did everything for JD, everything for him, because, you know, if somebody needs you, they'll keep you longer. That was my thought anyway. I have to be vigilant because I am a controller. And I have a tendency to want to do that. And controllers are fear-based. I had to watch my father die when I was 12, and I felt so powerless, so terribly powerless. It brought on a fear so great with me that it was imperative for me to have control of other areas in my life in order for me to have any feeling of comfort or security. But today I have learned that I am responsible for my own growth. That of mine and no one else. I know if JD were to die, God forbid, today, I would be okay. I would be okay in time. I can stand alone and be okay. And I'm never really alone because I have my higher power. I have the fellowship. I know that JD would be okay too. You see, we're each the last of our families. And when we're gone, that's it. So, we needed to know that each one of us could be okay if something happened to the other one. And JD has even learned to cook. Now, especially in the last few years when my mobility has gone down to zero almost, and I can't stand in the kitchen for an hour and cook. And it's very difficult to try to cook sitting on a stool, a high stool. So JD has learned to cook. Now, when we got married, JD could cook hot dogs. Well, wasn't that something? And one time when I was gone to a conference, he decided he wanted to have the little outdoor experience. And so he got some clothes hangers and put the hot dogs and roasted them on the coat hangers over my kitchen stove. This was not good. That grease went everywhere. And so he's learned not to do it that way now. because we had some words over that. But like I said, I am responsible for my own growth. And now JD has learned to cook lots of things. In fact, the other night he made fried green tomatoes. I was so proud of him. And I only had to show him one time how to do it. And that was several weeks ago. But I had to be okay because I had to have a man in my life. You see, a man made it okay. Daddy fixed everything for me. And he stood between me and mother and protected me from her. And so therefore, I looked outside of myself for someone to take care of me, to fill in those holes inside of me that I never released to someone unless I had someone else. You know, never get wed in one relationship till you got another one in the wings. You know, you don't want to go through a period of nobody, for God's sake, you know. And so when the things aren't going good in your relationship, you start trolling and you start looking around for the next victim. But you can't give what you don't have. See, that's what we learned in this relationship, is that we can't bring to a relationship what you don't have. So I have to know what my capabilities are as well as my limitations. Now, my first responsibility is to God, then to myself, to be the best I can be spiritually, emotionally, and spiritually, and physically, the best I can be. Well, you know, I blame JD for all of our money problems. You know, if he didn't drink and get thrown in jail and we wouldn't have to pay the fines and attorneys and all like that. But, you know, he would spend money we didn't have. And I would tell him all the time, over and over, you're spending money we don't have. And yet when he would go out and get drunk, it would piss me off. And so I would get revenge. And I would go to the mall and spend money we didn't have too. Now, when JD got sober, that expense ended. It took 4 years for mine to end because of my little happy trips to the mall getting even. It took me a long time, a long time. Another thing, I made sure he went to the doctor and he went to the dentist and what have you. Did I go? No, because I martyred. We can't afford it for both of us. And so, of course, JD got it. And the bottom line was, I didn't like going to the doctor. I hated the dentist. And so that wasn't the big martyr situation for me, but boy, I did it. I love being a martyr. On page 13 of Odette, you know, it says, do I secretly relish feeling sorry for myself and getting sympathy from others? And if you'd have told me that before I got here, I would have told you, you're out of your mind. I never feel sorry for myself. And I couldn't understand why my sponsor had me read that page every day for the first year. And because it was still true. It was still true. But I had those fears. I went to the dentist when I was about 8 or 9, and I got hurt. And as a result, I never wanted to go back to the dentist. And so I had this big fear of the dentist. And also, when I was 16, I started sneak smoking. You know, the kind that you put and hide, and then you get to school at lunch break, you go out and smoke at the smoking place. We called it the gar hole because it was like the cigars and cigarettes. And you go out there, but I didn't want my mama to know. You know, that was the thing. I remember one time seeing a cartoon that says, I don't care who you tell. Tell the whole world. Tell everybody. Just don't tell my mother. And that was the way I was. Just don't tell my mother. I didn't want her to know. But I smoked from the time I was 16. And so later on in life, you know, it began to be found out that cigarettes were not as fun as they used to be. And you could see them, and they kept talking about cancer and things like that. And so I tried several times to quit smoking, and I was addicted to the nicotine as well as the menthol because I smoked Salems. And thank God I quit what I did, because who would have dreamed they would have gotten so expensive? I thought I was killing myself when I was paying 75 cents a pack. Anyway, I decided, you know, if this program could work on smoking, give it a try. It works on alcohol. Maybe I could do it one day at a time. And every time I would try to quit smoking before, I would make a big production, tell everybody I'm quitting. This is it, the last one. And then when you break down and go have one, you feel so guilty and you don't want anybody to know. You're sneaking around. And I just didn't want to do that this time. I had bronchial pneumonia, that year at Christmas in 1985. And so I couldn't smoke. I did. I coughed, which was like just tearing your lungs out. And so I said to myself, I've been off cigarettes for 2 weeks and I want one really bad. So I knew I was improving because I wanted one. And I thought, if you've been off of it 2 weeks, physically, you're off of it. It's the emotional thing now. Why don't you do the one day at a time? And so I never quit smoking. It's just that I don't smoke one day at a time and haven't since December the 27th of 1985. So the program works in any area of your life that you want it to work. It will work. And I found out that instead of trying to close the barn door after the horse is gone, that preventive measures are better. They are. And you can be responsible for your own spiritual condition. You can't, you know, you can only hang on to somebody else's for so long. Now, my sponsor in the very beginning, she was my higher power, because if I needed something from God, I told her because I knew she was on good standing and I didn't have one. And so I would ask her to pray for the things I wanted. And so when they would happen, I'd say, see, God does it for her. But it was the day that he did it for me that it all came together for me, because you can't depend on somebody else all the time. You've got to depend on yourself, and you've got to have a relationship with your higher power. Because if experience has taught me anything, it is I am not trustworthy. I can't trust myself. You know, I can't trust myself to do the things that I want to do or that I can't remember, I forget, or whatever. So I have to have a power greater than me that can keep me straight. And if you're straight spiritually, if you've got your spiritual connection, your thinking is better. And if your thinking is better, your actions are better. So that's the way you know, that's how we get sick. We have a spiritual problem and we don't take care of the spiritual problem. And then our emotions, it's involved. There was the alcoholism, you know, I had no spiritual basis to go on. And here came the alcoholism. And so therefore my thinking and my reactions to it were way out away from a normal situation. And so then that's how my thinking went, you know. Because my thinking went, you know, I'm miserable, it's his fault. We can't get a divorce because we've had divorces. We don't want to be it. Our problem. It has to be somebody else's problem. He needs to die. And you see, that's not a normal progression to most people, but that was mine. That was mine. And so I had a blaming theory. Everything was wrong, was everybody else's fault. Well, if that is true, I might as well go jump off a bridge right now, because there's no hope for me. But if it's my stuff that's causing me problems, if it's my reactions, you can't change other people, but you can be willing to change yourself. And then there's hope. There's great hope when you can change yourself. And where does the hope come in? It comes in on step two, where we get some hope, where we come to believe, you know? So why? Why was a word that has always got me in trouble? Why? I have to know why. Now, why do I have to know why? Because if I know why, then I might have a way to figure out how to get my way. If I can figure out how you think and why you think the way you do, then I might can head you off at the pass. And the why, I got tickled. My daddy, one time we were down at the lake and he was so patient to answer all of my whys. And so I said to him, we were getting ready to get in the boat and he was carrying the motor and he stepped in the boat and I asked him, Daddy, why so-and-so? And so Daddy stood there holding the motor and explained to me why. And so then he took a step, stepped over the middle of the seat in the boat. And I said, well, Daddy, why so-and-so? Because every answer requires another question. And so I asked him again, why this? And he was telling me. And so I said, okay. And so then he stepped over the next seat. And I said, but Daddy, why so-and-so? And he stepped out the back end of the boat with the motor. I had distracted him to the point where he went in the water. I mean, he went under with the motor. And when Daddy came back out, he was not a happy camper. And he looked at me and I said, Daddy, why'd you do that? And he told me, shut up and go get in the car. See, I could drive a person to, JD called them the why sessions. Why did you do this? Why did you do that? Because see, if he could tell me why he did what he did, I might find a way to stop him from doing that. I was always trying to figure out another way. But you know, Father Hilary told me one time, he said, it doesn't matter how the horse got his ass in the mud, get it out. Even if you know why, it doesn't change it. You just know why. Big deal, you know? And it was like I said, well, it's like being on the Titanic. You know, we're laying there in the middle of the night, sleep, and all of a sudden you get this big jolt. And you think, I wonder what that was. Why did that happen? And so you run out of your room to check it out, and somebody said, get in the lifeboat, get in the lifeboat. You're going, why? And they're saying, you've got to find out why. And so everybody's trying to figure out why. And then instead of getting in the lifeboat, and so you said, let's say I was laying here and this happened and there's an iceberg over there. I wonder if we hit the iceberg. I wonder why. And everybody's leaving in the lifeboat. But guess who's going down with the Titanic? Because, see, I had to know why everything. So I'm going to drown. And that's what Father Hilary was trying to tell me. He said, you don't need to know why. What you're supposed to know will come to you without an action on your part. And you're asking questions is an action. So you don't have to know. And I just know that I have to be responsible for my own feelings. And it's just that simple. Okay, tradition 8. Our marriage or relationship should remain forever a free giving relationship, one to another. Now, let me ask you, are you a scorekeeper? I was. I didn't know I was. I thought I gave for fun and for free. But nope, there was usually a hidden price tag. And how that came about was when something came up for an opportunity to do something for me and you didn't, that's when the price tag came out on what I had, after all I've done for you. So now there's the price. There it is. I did something for you, therefore you owe me. And I hated being obligated. Oh my God, I hated that. But comparisons are a form of scorekeeping. When I compare what I do to what somebody else does, I'm keeping score. And there's no need to have to do that. And it was real funny because I would say to JD, like on the garbage, I'd say, it's your turn. And he'd say, what do you mean it's my turn? I said, it's your turn to take out the garbage. I've taken it out the last 12 times. Not that I'm counting. Of course I was counting. How did I know it was 12 times? If I hadn't been making a list in my mind, you know? Then there was the clothes hamper. Oh, my God. Why couldn't you get the clothes in the clothes hamper? What is it that men do that they can't put their clothes in the clothes hamper? Especially their shorts. What do they do to them that they leave them laying on the floor and can't pick them up and put them in the clothes hamper? I've always wondered about that. Anyway, that was the thing. I would keep score, and I would tell my sponsor about it. She says, well, don't do the things that you're going to keep a score on. I said, what do you mean? I want to do it without, she said, you got to do it without resentment or expectation for fun and for free. And I said, I don't want it for fun and for free. She said, then don't do it. Oh, you mean I cannot do it? She said, sure. And I said, you mean when he comes in the house and all his clothes, he starts dressing at the front, undressing at the front door. By the time he gets to the bathroom, he's down to his underwear. I said, and I have to come along behind him and pick up all, she said, where was the rule that you had to come behind him and pick up those clothes? Well, the dogs will get them and they'll be dragging them around. And she said, let the dogs drag them around. They're not your clothes. She said, you either pick them up and keep your mouth shut and don't bitch, or you leave them lay and don't bitch. I don't like my choices. I didn't like the choice. I want a bitch. And she said, no, you can't. So I told her, she said, okay, make a decision. So I made a decision. I wasn't going to bitch, and I was just going to let them lay. Can I tell you how hard that was? For a week, clothes were piling up all over where the dogs were dragging them. They were playing tug of war with his shorts. And, I mean, it was just unbelievable. And then he went to the meeting on Friday night. He came back home, and several of the guys came with him. And so he walked in the house. Now he sees the stuff. He has not seen it before now. But now he sees it. And he says, well, guys, you'll have to excuse the house. You can see Mary Pearl is not much of a housekeeper. And I said, yes, and y'all can see those are my jockey shorts. And so, you know, it was real funny. I never had to pick up his clothes again. It was like he had never seen them until that day. But it was when I quit doing that it became obvious to him what he wasn't doing. I didn't have to keep bitching about it all the time. And then, like, you know, it was like that carrying the garbage out. She said, you carry it out and don't bitch, or you let it sit and don't bitch. Well, you can only let it sit in the house so long. But so I would take it outside and I wouldn't bitch about it. And I didn't keep score. I just was doing it for me. I wasn't doing it for us. I was doing it so I didn't have to look at it or smell of it, you know? And so I found out in our Just for Today template, it says, you know, do things for fun and free. Do something you don't want to do just for discipline. There it was, something I didn't want to do just for the discipline. And then do something without being found out. That's the hardest one. Because when you need to have somebody to co-sign you and tell you you're okay, and you don't have that, you don't feel okay. So you have to learn to be able to tell yourself you did okay instead of depending on someone else to do it. And to see how long you could go and who could find out, who couldn't find out. It became a game. It was great fun. I've received freely of God's unconditional love and acceptance. So I need to give back to others because it makes me feel good to do so. It just makes you feel good. And the first relationship I could even do this with or try was with my sponsor. And after I had been sponsored about a year, Christmas was coming up, and I said, I'd like to give you something for Christmas, and I want it to be something you'd like to have. What would you like to have? And she said, the nicest thing you can give me is pass it on to someone else. Pass on. Share what God has done for you to someone else. She said, that'd be the greatest gift you could ever give me. And I thought, no, I really want to give you something. And she said, no, that's what I want. You asked me what I want. And I found out, you know, it's really nicer. Give people something they want instead of trying to guess what they want, you know. So that first year was a real learning experience, you know. When JD and I were going to go to that first conference and we didn't have the money to go, and he'd been off work over 6 months, and I had such financial fear. I mean, it was unbelievable. And when we went to the conference, we had saved up just enough money that we thought that it would take, except for $35. And we had prayed. JD and I had prayed together. That was the first thing we ever prayed for together. We got on our knees by the side of the bed and we prayed, God, we'd like to go to the conference, if it be your will. And then I went to work and I called on the watch line and I made a reservation in Hot Springs where the big conference was going to be. And I called the hotel. So 30 minutes later, JD called. And he had just gotten a job. And it was real funny. See, we prayed and then we took an action. He went to look one more time and I made a reservation and God kicked in. And there it was, you know, we could go. Well, we still got to pay for all that stuff. And so I had figured it up, like I say, to the last penny what it would cost if we ate cheese and crackers in the room. And when we got there to the conference, well, before that, I had told him, I said, you don't have anything to wear to a conference because we didn't know if you dressed formally or whatever. And his clothes all had holes in it where he would smoke when he was drunk and he would smell the ashes on him. And this was the day of polyester when everything melted and you had these nice little holes everywhere. And so he looked like he was a walking colander. And so we ordered through the mail from Chicago to a mail order place. A closeout on suits. It had two pairs of pants, reversible vest, and a coat. And it came on Monday before the conference started on Thursday, and we were short $35. And I told him, I guess I'll have to call and cancel. But we tried. We did our best. We tried. And he was trying on the suit before he sent it back. And in the pocket of the pair of pants was a 20, a 10, and a 5. And I said, I would never have thought to tell God to put it there. Would you ever? You know, God is so funny and so sneaky. He sent it in the least way I would have ever dreamed, because how would it come from a pair of pants from a mill or a house in Chicago with just exactly what you needed? And we got there, and we were getting ready to eat our cheese and crackers. And did you know, for every meal, someone in AA invited us out to eat. You see, they knew we were trying. And we were able to do that because of their love and because they did something to make them feel good. And it sure made us feel good. And we fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. They were so good to us. And then for the banquet, you know, you had to have banquet tickets. We couldn't afford those. We were feeling sorry for ourselves. Now, we've had all these meals, but yet, you know, it's never enough for a newcomer. And all of a sudden, I noticed, or JD did, he said, there's an envelope in the floor over by the door. And I picked it up, and in it were two banquet tickets. And they were, the tickets were with the speakers at the speakers table. And somebody gave up their tickets so that we could have that. And like I say, it was the most marvelous thing. We just knew we had to keep working this program and do this, because this was a wonderful, wonderful thing. And man, if you want to get hooked on conventions, that's the way to go. I'm here to tell you. The thing about it is, with me, for so long, when I felt obligated to somebody, I felt out of control. Now, the giver is in control. You give what you want, when you want, how you want. The receiver is vulnerable. And I didn't like feeling vulnerable. And I didn't know, so I would keep score. And if you give me something, I had to give you something, because I didn't know how to make that balance out. And I learned that in here, you say, thank you. That takes care of it. That takes care of it. Thank you and no are complete sentences. You know, I always had to justify everything to me and to you. And if I had to tell you no about something, I had to explain to you why the answer was no. And the bottom line is, you don't. No is a complete sentence. You do not. So is thank you. And you have to learn to accept the gift graciously. You know, somebody comes up and says, oh, I love your blouse. This old thing, Blue Light Special, Kmart, 10 years ago. Well, you've just told that person that obviously their eyes are deceiving them, or they're an idiot, because this is an old shirt that you got at Kmart. Instead of just saying, thank you. Wouldn't that have been so much nicer, you know? And when the computers first came out, I'd always used an IBM typewriter for years, and at work. And all of a sudden, you know, they come up with computers. Well, I wasn't working then. And so I'm thinking computer. It would be so much nicer to have something where you could print it off and over and do different things. But I don't know how to do any of that. And they're very expensive. When computers first came out, we're talking $3,000, $4,000 for a computer. I mean, that was a big, big deal. And I said, I couldn't afford something like that. And so I started a computer fund, because my sponsor tells me, if you want something, work toward it. So I started a fund, and I had this little jar, and I had about $7 or $8 in my computer fund. And slow, but sure, you know, just change whenever you had it, put it in. Because I really didn't know what to get. Now, I'd heard the buzzwords, and one of the buzzwords that they came up with was, it has to be IBM compatible. I heard that a lot. And I didn't know what it meant, but, and God forbid you ask somebody what it means, because then they'll know you don't know. And so anyway, I went to a Christmas party. Well, actually, it was after Christmas party at this guy's house. Girl I sponsored's husband was an attorney. And when we got there, it was like, I mean, it was almost past New Year's. And lo and behold, there was a Christmas tree still decorated sitting in the living room. And I thought, what in the hell are they doing with a Christmas tree up this late in the day? And then he was talking, we said it was so pretty, and he said his mother had done it. I thought, your mother decorates your Christmas tree? Okay, let it go. Don't be judgmental and critical. It was pretty. So we went out and we had this fabulous meal. And then afterwards, we went back into this living room, and there was several of us, and we all sat down, and he said, I believe there's something under the tree still, or a package or two. And he went over there and he said, Murph, I believe these are for you. I said, what? And so I opened the first package up, and it was a keyboard. And I said, oh, it's like an add-a-pearl necklace. I start off with a keyboard. I'm on my way to my computer. And then the next package was the computer, a big computer and a printer. And I said, is it IBM compatible? He said, probably, it's an IBM. Okay, so I'm an idiot, okay? But, and then it dawned on me, I have no idea how to do anything with this computer. You know, I don't have anything. And so one of the girls in the group worked for Systematics, which was one of the first computer places we had here. And so she taught me how to do the computer. She taught me how to give it commands. Back in those days, you had to tell them what to do. You didn't just push a button or this or that. Anyway, I had to think, now, can I accept a gift like this? And I thought, what do you do? And I said, thank you very much. That's what I did, and it was good. Life is not fair. And if you, I don't know where I got the idea that life was not fair, because I kept going around, it's not fair, it's not fair, you know? And I said, well, you know, in my case, I need to be grateful life isn't fair, because what you sow, you reap. And I had sowed a lot of bad seed along the way getting here, you know? And the thing about it is, when you give from free, from the heart, for fun and for free, everything is returned to you, not necessarily from where you gave it, but from somewhere else. It will always come back to you. When you do good, good comes back, you know? And because what goes around comes around. And God in his time and in his way will return to you those things that you feel. And so you never lose anything by giving something. And it's like later on when I got a newer computer, as time goes on, you do that. I gave the old one to a girl I sponsored who didn't have one. And so you just keep passing it on. What was given to me, you pass on, whether it's program, whether it's things. And I was thinking about the time I was passing that on, you know, I could really use some cash. Maybe I should sell this. And I thought, no, it was given to you. Give it away. I said, okay. I do a lot of talking to myself. And I argue with myself too at times. But I gave this computer away, and I was wanting the money because I had lost a lot of weight and I didn't have any clothes that fit anymore. And then I was sponsoring this other girl, and she said that her daughter had bought a bunch of clothes and that she had gained so much weight she couldn't get in them, and some of them still had the tags on them. And she brought them over, and they were a perfect fit. So looky there, you know. It's amazing how God meets our needs. Another time, when my sister was in the hospital, she had to have open-heart surgery and a triple bypass. And times were pretty hard for us financially, trying to take care of everything we were trying to take care of, like paying back some of my bills and stuff. And so it was pouring down rain, and I went to the post office that morning. And when I got out of the car to go in, there was a dollar bill wadded up on the pavement there in the water. And I got it out, shook it out, threw it in the car, and went on in and came back out. And then later that evening, I remembered that dollar bill was overlaying in the floorboard. It was $100 bill. And it was just what we needed to be able to go to the store and get groceries. You know, our needs were met. Our needs were met, you know. My self-worth cannot be because of outside sources. It's an inner job. And my self-worth comes from being a child of God. I'm entitled to the best life that life has to offer. And when I look for the best, I get exactly what I need. every time. You know, Winnie Eddy used to say, how do you serve cake? And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, when you're cutting cake, and I said, well, it depends on what all I have. And she said, well, when I cut cake, she said, I used to do it this way. I cut equal pieces for all my kids, a big piece for my husband, and then whatever's left, that was mine. And she had a big family. And I said, so? And she said, well, you take a piece and you give your husband a big piece. And she said, but the thing of it is, take the first piece of cake. You deserve the first piece of cake. Before you give to others, you got to take care of yourself before you give to others. And that way my self-worth wasn't dependent upon others. You know, when I let how I feel about me depend on what you think about me, shame on me. I'm shouldn't on myself, you know. Quit doing that, you know. Be the best, you know. I looked for years for my mother to give me love in the way I wanted to receive love. My mother didn't have it to give. Now, my sister was giving me the kind of love I wanted all of those years. I didn't recognize it. It wasn't coming from the source I was expecting it from. And so I didn't give her any thank you for what all she'd done. I just accepted that's what sisters do. And then I met other people that had sisters and they go, no, that's not what they do. And I'm going, well, maybe it's because she's so much older than me. Well, true, Dorothy was 16 years older than me and she couldn't have children and neither could I. And so I was like a child to her because she had pretty much took care of me at home because my mother was doing her thing. My mother was always a workaholic, you know, if you're not working, you're not worth anything. And so here it was, not only had I give mother a bad report on being a mother because she didn't do it, I didn't give Dorothy a good report for being the best sister because I was missing it all. I was missing it because I was looking for something. I was going to a dry hole. Now, if you go to a dry hole and expect water, how many times are you going to have to go to that dry hole? I think probably after one or two, you'd find another place to go to get water, but I didn't. Not when it was emotional. I didn't. I kept going back to my mother, wanting her to give me something, and she didn't have it, but I didn't know she didn't have it. You know, are you a mind reader? And if you are, does it really work? You have to communicate your needs to somebody. You know, and that he ought to know. He ought to know. He ought to know. Well, he don't know if you don't tell him. You know, that's like at Christmas time and for gifts and what have you. The first year we got married, J.D. gave me. He gave me a beautiful silk scarf from a boutique. Very expensive scarf. Do you see a neck? You know, I didn't have a neck. Why was I going to put the damn scarf on? And then he got me a red silk umbrella. Now, what am I going to do with a red silk umbrella? And I'm thinking, why is he giving me dumb stuff like this? And so I never appreciated what he gave me because it wasn't anything I ever wanted. And but did I tell him what I wanted? No, he's supposed to know. How's he supposed to know? He's supposed to pay attention. Well, JD, I swear to God, he has ADD. They didn't diagnose it when he was a kid. He went to a one-room schoolhouse. They didn't diagnose it, but I have on good authority from some of the physicians we know that, yeah, he does, you know, but he doesn't pay attention. He tries very hard, but he doesn't pay attention very well. And so I didn't communicate. So finally, you know, he said to me, he said, you know, why don't you make a list of what you'd like and all the information that goes with it, like what size and what color or whatever, you know, those kind of things. So I'd have some kind of idea of what and where to go get it. And he said, then you might get something you want where you don't have to have a National Exchange Day the day after Christmas. You know, it didn't work. And when he, you know, the thing about it is JD did a lot of things I didn't expect. Like, for instance, every time I'd get mad at him, when he was drinking especially, he would send me flowers. And one day I got an almost funeral size spray at the office. I thought, God, I wonder what he's done this time. I really wonder. And he would send these flowers, and everybody at the office would say, oh, her husband's so sweet and kind. Look, he's always sending her flowers. And I wanted to tell them, but I'm paying for them because he's charging them to me. But I didn't. My ego wouldn't let me tell them the truth, you know. And so it came around Valentine's Day. And so everybody at the office all day long getting flowers and stuff, and they're all waiting to see what Mary Pearl gets, because Mary Pearl gets big flowers for no reason, you know. I didn't get so much as a leaf. And when I went out to get in the car, when he came to pick me up from work, I was so embarrassed, humiliated, and what have you, because everybody kept coming by to see my flowers that wasn't there. And so I got in the car, and so I'm just not going to talk to him. And so in a few minutes, he said, okay, what have I done? And I said, where are my flowers? He said, your flowers? And I said, yeah, you always send me flowers. Today, everybody in the office got flowers but me on the day you're supposed to get the flowers. And he said, you expected them? And I said, most certainly I expected them. And he said, well, I called. And they told me they already had more deliveries than they could make. And I said, and you couldn't call someplace else? He said, I didn't know where you had a charge account someplace else. And I just looked at him and I said, you're impossible. And he said, well, I can fix this for you. I said, how? He said, don't ever expect anything on Valentine's Day, because I'm not going to ever give you anything. And he hasn't. He was a man of his word. But, you know, that taught me a lesson. That taught me a lesson. And then one time I was real angry with him, and I came home and I said, you haven't mentioned it all day long. He said, mentioned what? I said, this is our wedding anniversary. He stood there for a minute and he said, wrong husband. Oh, you're right. You're right. It was. It was. I was. The first time I got married was the 16th of September. This isn't the 7th of November. Oh, I have. And I had been mad at him all day long about something that wasn't even his problem. I couldn't help but laugh. And when he said wrong husband, and I thought, he's wrong. He's right. It was a wrong husband. So I asked myself, can I do this for fun and free? And if I can't, I don't. You know, I learned from my mother's death some things. You know, my mother would have been, she wasn't a hoarder from the standpoint like you see on the TV where you can't walk in a room or anything like that. But my mother had all of this stuff she was afraid to get rid of. She had a huge house, and she had a double car garage and two outbuildings of stuff that she might need. But you know, my mother was born in 1900. And when she went through the Depression, she lost all of her money that was in the bank. And so my mother was always afraid you were going to need something and not have it, because she went through a lot of her life like that. And so therefore she wouldn't get rid of anything. And I found all these rubber balls, and I wondered why she was keeping, and then it hit me, those aren't rubber balls. Those are rubber bands that had, she would put them and roll them up and make a ball out of them. And with the heat that we have here in Arkansas, they had welded together and become rubber balls. But that was rubber bands from probably years and years of taking them off the newspaper that came every morning. Stuff like that, you know. And so my job is to give. God's job is to return. And my mother would say, well, if you give that away, what if you need it later? And I said, God will return it to me. And she said, are you sure? And I said, yeah. You see, I've been given a lot more than I ever deserved, because God is very generous, especially to me. Tradition 9, a family or relationship should be pliable in its organization, but our group conscience may appoint certain persons responsible to serve various functions. An atmosphere of love and freedom and acceptance are wonderful in which to live, but it's something you're going to have to work at every day, one day at a time. See, growth is done individually, not as a unit. And one person may grow have a growth spurt in an area and then the other one may have one, but very seldom do we have it together on the same thing. And when we're living together, we need to have a set of mutually agreed upon guidelines for acceptable conduct for the relationship. So we know what to expect and not to expect, as well as establishing responsibility for the various items that arise in daily living. You know, we need to have some guidelines. Now, these are the ones that we have. They may not be yours. You have to come up with your own. But number one, God is the head of our home. God is to have an active role in our home and the decisions made for our relationship in our home. Number two, no alcohol or drugs on the premises. Some people say they keep alcohol because they entertain and what have you, and it's fine. It was a mutual decision that the alcohol had caused enough hell in our home. We didn't want it there anymore. Number three, no infidelity. In my first relationship, my first marriage, I was unfaithful. JD, when he drank, was unfaithful. We know this doesn't work. And I asked myself, why did I accept his infidelity when we were married, when JD? And it was because I had done it before in the marriage before, and I felt like I deserved it. Isn't it funny how that stuff comes back? I found that out in an inventory. Another one, number four, no expenditures of over $100 without prior discussion and agreement. Because when we first set up these guidelines, $100 was a lot of money. It still is a lot of money because we live on a fixed income. So, therefore, we need to discuss stuff before we...
Eso $100 será mucho gasto.
I'm sorry.
The Spanish... It's a transition, Merp. Just ignore.
Okay. Thank you. No obligations or commitments for each other without prior agreement. In other words, JD can't make a commitment for me or I make one for him. And see, I used to do that just like nothing. Somebody would say, y'all want to come over and have dinner and play cards? And I said, yeah, we'd love to. And I'd come home and I'd say, JD, we're going to go over. So, and he'd go, I'm tired. I don't feel like going over there. And I said, but I told him, we've got to go. You've got to go now. And he'd say, but I really, and he'd go, even though he didn't want to go. And then it just didn't turn out so well. So he asked me one time, he said, why can't you tell him I can get back to you? Oh, because I was in control. I could answer for both of us. He said, well, next time I'm not going. And next time he didn't go. And so I learned from that. Ask him first and say to them, I'll get in touch with JD and see if he can do that or if we have other plans or something. And so that way, I wasn't answering for JD. I was letting him decide what he wanted to do and not do. So that was one of the things that was a sore spot for him. Personal privacy and quiet time. Each one of us needs our individual space, especially during this pandemic. And we've been in the house together since the second week of March. You know, the house gets a little smaller sometimes when you're locked in. But you know, we each have our special time. And when I say I want to have my own little quiet time, he leaves me alone. I have to have my own quiet time. And then we have special hour time. We started having date nights where we would just, I'd tell the people I sponsor, unless it's a dire emergency after 4 o'clock, do not call me because we're going to be, even if we just sat home and talked, it was our time to be together without interruption. And that worked. Nowadays, we have so much our time. We have too many date nights. I think sometimes we have a lot of together. Common courtesy. You know, I would be more courteous to a complete stranger than I was being in my relationships. I took them for granted. And so I learned that you can't do that. Any autonomous action is measured by its negative effect on the relationship. In other words, I can do anything I want to do through autonomy, but it has to be measured against the effect on the relationship. So, and then number 10, no dredging up past relationships or using the past as a weapon. And JD would say things like, well, when I was married to what's her name, and what have you, and then I would say to him, well, you know, I never had to, and I and I kept a record of everything he ever did wrong in my head. And I could tell him the day and the time. I was really bad about that. So we had to learn to put the past in the past. If you're going to have a future together, you're going to have to live in today. And that means keeping the past in the past and doing the best you can today. Next was the application of the rules for healthy communication, like in the dilemma of the alcoholic marriage. Discuss, don't attack. Talk in a low voice. Stick to the subject. You can't just do that. And another thing, listen to the other person's complaints and don't make demands. Those rules of communication really work when you work them. Another one, 12, don't try to work the other person's program or tell them how. You really have a tendency to want to do that, especially when you're both in the program. And after God, my personal recovery comes first before our partners. You have to come first. God first, you second, partners third. Then we had the untouchables. Those subjects that whenever we got to talking about them, we'd get angry. And nothing would ever get resolved. You'd just stomp off. And then you'd come back at another time and have another go at it. And it wouldn't work. And so those were ideas that we would just, we couldn't talk about his family. We couldn't talk about my family. There were so many subjects we couldn't talk about because we argued about it. And so finally we decided we wanted to get rid of these untouchables. And so whenever a situation would come up, we would sit in two chairs with our knees touching, facing one another, and we were holding hands, and we would talk it through and resolve it instead of somebody going away. And we did that one by one on those issues until we don't have the untouchables anymore. We don't have those things. Honesty and trust must be observed. I've got to be able to believe what he says that he will do when he says he will do it, and vice versa. Trying to work as a team wherever possible. In other words, work together on things instead of pulling apart on things. Joint decisions regarding changes in the home or yard. He can't go out there and make a major change, like say he's going to chop down a tree or something without. It's my yard too. It's my home too. I don't ever try to change something in the house without asking him, what do you think about showing him what I'm talking about? Maybe having him go with me to look at a piece of furniture or what have you. We just don't do that. And see, I did stuff like that, you know, when I went to buy that car, you know, he didn't want a station wagon. I wanted it. And so I bought it regardless of what he wanted. Well, today, that wouldn't be the case. If he didn't want it that badly, then we wouldn't have it that, because he had his reasons. But we've learned. We have learned to give in for the best part of the relationship and working as a team. We made a list of jobs and duties that it takes for running the house, and we decided who liked to do what. Well, there was things he liked to do, and there's things I like. Then now there's this other column over here of all these things that nobody wants to do. So what we do on that is that we take turns. We take turns on doing the things we don't want to do. And then that way it all gets done. And when one feels that the other is not adhering to the guidelines or the responsibilities, bring it up in a positive way and not as a blaming. Don't say, you didn't do this or you're not doing that. You say, I have a problem. Can we talk about it? And don't say you. Say, I feel this is happening. I feel this is going on. Instead of pointing a finger going, you, because that automatically puts someone on the defense. And when someone has a responsibility, let them do it. Let them do it in their own time and in their own way. You know, my mama used to drive me crazy. She'd come into my room and she'd look around at it, and I had killed myself getting that room perfect for inspection. And mama would come in and she'd find the one thing I hadn't seen. And she would say, it's her house. and she makes the rules for her house. And so Mama said one time, as she was getting a lot older, she said, now, I want one of you girls to live here after I'm gone. And I said, it won't be me. And she said, well, boy, that was quick. And I said, that's right, it won't be me. And I said, because Mama, it was your house. It was never my home. I said, think about it. I was in a crib and you're in Daddy's bedroom. And I moved there to Bobby's bedroom. And then after Bobby, I moved into Dorothy's bedroom. Did you hear Mary Pearl's bedroom? Did you hear it? It wasn't there. Because even though I was staying in Dorothy's old room, it was always called Dorothy's room. It was never called Mary Pearl's room. And there were drawers in the chest of drawers that I was told I could not touch or open. And so I said, it was never my home to me. My home is where I live right now. And no, I won't be living in the home. And Dorothy said, nor she would either. So after Mama passed away, we auctioned it off because neither one of us had good memories about living there. And that's sort of sad when you think about it. But thank God I won't feel the same way about this. You have to be aware of your limitations and your partner's limitations. You know,